STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
The show is Stand to Reason. I'm Brett Kunkel, sitting in for Greg Kokel. I am taking over as host today because we actually have a very special guest. And actually, I did not think that Greg was adequate to interview this guest, actually. That's because the guest is actually Greg Kokel, my boss, my friend, my colleague, my mentor, but not my father. Greg. So, Greg,
here we go.
Greg, welcome to your show.
Yeah, this is Turnabout here, and it'll take me a moment or two to get used to it. But you know, I actually would rather be interviewed than be doing the interviewing, because I know that if you ask me a question, it's about something that, in this case, I've written, so I probably have a handle on it. I can answer the question. And the minute I stop talking, all the pressure's on you.
Well,
so I've got the easy job here, Brett.
Well, actually, what I can count on is that that you will do a lot of the talking.
that's probably right.
Well, what we want to do in this hour is talk about Greg's new book. If you're not aware of this book, you should ask for forgiveness. Of course, we at Stand to Reason have been looking forward to this book for a long time. It's the story of reality, how the world began, how it ends, and everything important that happens in between. That is a big, bold statement, but
yeah.
It accurately captures this book. If you go on to Amazon.com, you look up The Story of Reality, look at the reviews. I was looking at the reviews today, 32 reviews. All of them are 5-star reviews. And actually, some of the reviews that were written, I thought were very interesting. In fact, one of them caught my attention. It started off with, "This is a weird book." If I were a curious spiritual seeker, it would be the most intriguing thing I've ever read. But as a believer, it's like a skilled wordsmith hacked into my mind and put it into print. I've read over 100 apologetics books, and I'm here to tell you this one is really different in a good way.
Wow.
These are the kind of reviews that are on there. One of them, this was heavy. It was Apart from the Bible, among my favorite books of all time. The Story of Reality. And mm-hmm. That's huge. Those are big shoes to fill.
Well,
right there.
Yeah. Well, you know, The Story of Reality is about the biblical story too. So there's a kinship there. I'm kind of hitchhiking on the coattails of the greatest story ever told and on the coattails of the most popular bestseller of all time, the Bible.
Yeah. Now some would say this is a worldview book, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So people are going to say, well, there are a lot of worldview books out there.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we need this book? Mm-hmm. Why this one, Greg?
Well, worldview books, I think, largely give a kind of what's the best way of putting it? They kind of quantify or categorize different ways of looking at the world. That's what a worldview is. It is a view of the way the world actually is. Now, a lot of people don't think of it that way. They've heard the phrase worldview so much that it's just another one of those kind of religious catchphrases, and they take it as, well, this is just somebody else's trip, you know. So you have religions, which are your fantasy story that makes you feel good, and now if you've been around for a while, well, we've just substituted the word worldview for it. But no, I think what worldviews are meant to be is what the title of this book indicates. They are meant to be stories of the way the world actually is, and in that sense, they can't all be correct. And I'm not just cataloging worldviews in this regard in this book. I'm not just trying to say here's a bunch of worldviews and here's Christianity, which is one of them, or even to say this is one of many and this is why this one's better. There's a little bit of that in portions of the book, but more than anything else, what I'm trying to do, Brett, is I'm trying to make clear for everyone And I don't mean just the non-Christian. I mean the Christian. I mean the Christian's been around for a long time. Exactly how their story hangs together in a coherent fashion. From the beginning to the end, how the world began, how it ends, and everything important that happens in between. By the way, it sounds like an expansive title, but that word important is really important in that phrase. It's the key things that matter in the big picture. It's not a history of history. It's about what this whole enterprise called life, called history, called the world is all about. And so I'm trying to show that the Christian take of reality, the Christian worldview, covers the bases, answers the questions in a way so much better than any others. In fact, it answers the questions in a way that resonate with our deepest intuitions about the way the world actually is, which is what I think one of the most powerful features of the Christian world happened to be.
Yeah, and I think with this book, a lot of worldviews come at this very academically and systematically, and yours is still systematic, but it's you would say you put it kind of in a narrative form. You put it in story form that makes the reading of this so not just easy but enjoyable. And I think that is what you hear in some of the reviews that I've read, is that this was a good read. In fact, one of the reviews on Amazon said, as soon as I read it, I was actually looking forward to reading it again.
And so that's
one thing that's so distinct about this. It's not just kind of this dry, overly academic, kind of systematic treatment of the Christian worldview.
Well, thank you, Brett, for saying that, because this was my most difficult challenge, okay? You've read the book. You know, in a certain sense, there's very little that is unique about the content, all right? It is the Christian story. That's kind of been around for a while, you know? So,
oh, you didn't invent that?
And so it isn't like people are going to hear something new. What my challenge was helping people to approach this not as a theological enterprise, but to embrace it as a drama. As in a certain sense, the story unfolded historically. And that's what I do from beginning to end, from the beginning, in the beginning to the end, the final resurrection. We have this unfolding story. And as you see the unfolding story, you see the coherence of it, how it kind of all fits together in a logical structure, so to speak. But it, like you said, it's not a book of logic and theology. And I spent more time, Brett, on the what writers might call the voice of the book than anything else. I wanted it to sound friendly, just like you said. I wanted it to seem like this was me having a personal conversation with someone. I'm not just talking out there, laying this out. I'm having a conversation with the reader. And it is reminiscent of Lewis. He was my model in this, actually, and a McDonald before him.
Actually, I think it's interesting kind of what you did as you were writing. Give us a little insight from the writer's perspective.
Well, this is it's just a skosh embarrassing to say this, but because it might strike some people as odd, but it really is part of the craft, okay? Voice is part of the craft. And there are different voices that a person could have for different kind of writing. Solid ground, bang, 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 3,500 words, get in, get out. Give the reader the most information, take from him the least time. Not this one. Not a story, okay? And so what I did, since I mentioned that Lewis was my model, and Mere Christianity more specifically, I was trying to, in a certain sense, mimic the role that Mere Christianity played in Christians' life 50 years ago and since, which is out of the reach of some people nowadays just because the academic level of folks has gone down. I wanted to kind of accomplish something similar if the comparison isn't too bold. I'm always a little uncomfortable when I make this comparison. But what I did is every session before I started writing, I would go to YouTube and I'd find, I had it all bookmarked, and I'd find a section where a British person was reading Mere Christianity. And I would just sit there and listen to, you know, for all we know, C.S. Lewis telling his story, Mere Christianity. I mean, it wasn't Lewis, obviously, but it was a British person, so one could imagine. And so I've just got that rhythm, I just finished reading Stephen King's book on writing, titled On Writing, and he mentions this. He says, sometimes it's natural to borrow from other writers to kind of build your own style. And in this case, I didn't really want my style. I wanted I wanted Lewis's warmth and pacing, and also what I call soft apologetics, which I think is characteristic of Lewis's writing. Mm-hmm. It was like thoughtful reflections that are friendly appeals to common sense insights that we all have about the world that end up pointing to the truthfulness of the Christian take on reality. And it's not overly argumentative, so it's not like I'm banging heads with the reader. I'm saying, hey, think about it for a moment, you know, much the way Lewis does in his work.
Yeah, and it's that style that partly makes Lewis's work so enduring. Yeah. And why it's a classic. And I love the insight, because I think for those who are listening, and for me, kind of watching you on this journey, it helps us, number one, to think about whatever our craft is, paying attention to those who do the craft well.
Right.
And sit in a way, you're being mentored by Lewis.
That's right. And that's really true.
Yeah. And so, and so whatever the craft is,
right.
I mean, we all, you know, ought to pursue excellence in that. And this is one of the ways to
do
it.
We do this very thing as public speakers, and we've knocked this around together, you know, listening to somebody and we think, boy, that person's good. And then thinking, well, wait a minute, what is it that person is doing right now that is causing this section to have me respond, boy, that's good? And many times you can identify it. And if you can identify it as a technique, then you can begin to employ it in your own speaking style, for example. And we've learned a lot of things like that. But the same thing is true of writing, too.
Yeah, and I just got to say, I mean, your endorsers themselves, multiple endorsers, talked about how kind of this is Lewis-esque. And I think that's a huge compliment. It kind of speaks to the work that you put into this.
Well, I'm very touched by that. I got to admit, I mean, even though I tell you this, and I was trying, that was my goal and whatever, and I hear people say this, I'm still a bit embarrassed when I hear that, because I think C.S. Lewis was an alien from another planet. I mean, this guy, he's untouchable. He's in a world of his own as a thinker and as a communicator. I'm just hoping that some of that skill that he has in communicating rubbed off enough on me to improve the quality of the story of reality. And, you know, from what you say and others have said, maybe that's somewhat true.
Yeah. Okay, so the story of reality. Let's get to the story.
Sure.
Why don't you give us the big picture first and how you've organized that kind of into the five key elements? Because I think having people step back from the story, getting that big picture is really helpful.
Yeah. There were two things that kind of governed what I'm about to say here in these five things. One of them is, for years now, maybe 20 years, I have thought about trying to construct a presentation that would include all of the core elements of Christianity, the sine qua nons, that without which Christianity would no longer be Christianity. But I wanted to do it in a way that was memorable. Okay, well, the organization, the structure came first, and when I started teaching this about 20 years ago, this was a very left brain enterprise, and it wasn't until over time that it converted into more of a right brain thing. But the structure that I came up with was five words. And I'll give them to you. They're very easy to remember. I just count them off of my fingers. And when I taught this in my own church a few years ago, my 9-year-old, when she was 7, she was there ticking them off because she remembered them. They're really easy. And I figure if my 7-year-old can get it, pretty much anybody can get it, all right? Here they are. God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection. Simple. God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection. Not only are those five things central to the Christian story, theologically central. They are subjects, if you will, of systematic theology, actually. Theology proper, anthropology, Christology, soteriology, eschatology. I mean, those are theologies there when you're thinking. I don't use any of those words in the book, but those are core. But you notice something about this. They also tell the most important things that happened in the order they took place. So this turns out to be the backbone, the plot line of the Christian story. Our story starts with God. Then he created man to be in friendship with him, but man got himself in a heap of trouble. And so God initiates a rescue plan by becoming a man himself in the person of Jesus. And what he does in his life and then on a cross determines what will happen to everybody else at the final resurrection. There it is, God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection. With that structure in mind, especially as you get some of the meat of it as you read through the book, some of the understanding, that represents a kind of way of characterizing or structuring the Christian story for anyone. If you want to tell anybody about Christianity, there's your outline. Mm-hmm. It's right there for you. Handy, so to speak.
Yeah, five,
right at hand.
Five words, very easy to memorize right there, that gives the big picture, which is, I think, so important, and we'll talk a little bit about why that's so important. But let me step back now, because the first section is entitled Reality, and it's actually, I think, a really important section before you actually even get into those five
that's right.
words. And I think you are, on page 22, you ask a really good question that is a question I think we should actually ask all Christians, but when you hear the question, you think, well, that's kind of basic, but it's a kind of question I guarantee most Christians would have difficulty answering.
Right, right.
And that's the question, what is Christianity?
Yeah.
And so why did you pose the question that way? What were you trying to do there?
Well, you know, I travel a bit as you do, and I get an airplane, I talk to people at what I do, and they ask me, and I tell them, and I, you know, and they tell me, well, what do you write about? What do you speak about? What do you do radio about? And now I want to talk to them about Christianity, but I realize that when I do, they're gonna have the wrong idea about what I'm talking about. They're going to think like most people think. Well, religion is what you kind of latch on to, some story that makes you feel good. It's Marx's opiate of the people, and this is how people can say everybody's right about religion, because they don't think anybody's right about religion. Everybody's just choosing their own flavor, and that's all you can say about it, you know. And this, I do not want to give him that impression, or anybody that impression. I want them to see that what Christianity is not just a religion, as some might say it. It's not just a relationship with God or with Jesus, some might say that, or it's an ethical viewpoint, a way to live a satisfying life. All of those are kind of pictures from the inside, Brett. They're from the subject's perspective. And that's the kind of thing that people say, oh, nice, that's great, and then dismiss as not having anything to do with them. But Jesus did not see this project first from the inside. There were certainly internal ramifications, obviously, but he saw it first from the outside. He saw it as a picture of reality, about the way the world actually is. And if this isn't reality, then nothing on the inside ultimately means anything. Because if we're just fooling ourselves with a religious placebo, well, that doesn't do us any good in the long run. And so my struggle coming out of that dealing in this first section was to try to help the reader to see, look, you may not agree with my take on reality. All right. Maybe I'll change your mind, maybe not. But please understand, I am talking about reality. I am not talking about my religious fantasy. And this is a point a lot of Christians have not really gotten their teeth into either.
Yeah, and I think the church has been socialized, influenced by the culture, and so you hear Christians say things like, well, they kind of qualify their beliefs by saying, well, this is what I believe, or this is what I personally believe.
Right, right.
And we talk in those terms, and so that's why I think
Christian faith teaches.
Right,
you know, things
right.
like that.
And so that's why I think your opening is so important, to kind of lay that important groundwork, particularly when we talk about kind of story and narrative and those things.
Yeah.
Now,
partly because the relativistic impulse is so thoroughgoing in our culture, particularly when it comes to religion and morality.
Yes. And so when you talk about the story of reality, it needs to be understood in a particular way. And that's what you open with.
Mm-hmm.
And that first chapter there is on confusion,
right?
Which is a good kind of clearing up some of the confusion, what you mean to get you into this. Now, I think one thing that's really helpful, and I've always, even before I was part of the staff of Stand to Reason, one of the things that you do so well and that Stand to Reason, I think, does so well because of your influence is putting handles on ideas and illustrating things so that these concepts are translated. So we talk about worldview. It sounds academic. I don't think people get a good grasp, but you use a great analogy that I want you to explain here about the puzzle.
Right.
And I think that analogy really can kind of, as people who are listening, maybe who are Stand to Reason people, who they understand worldview, but in their role of teaching others, this is a real analogy that you can grab onto and teach others.
I say Christianity is a picture of reality. It's a view of the way the world actually is, worldview, if you will. But this is a picture that's made up of pieces. So what you have is you have particulars that are in our worldview. All worldviews are like that. They're all particular things. So we have the cross. We have Jesus. We have David. We have Mosaic Covenant. We have New Covenant. We have the Second Coming. We have all kinds of particulars that are all scattered in there. And Christians are often well acquainted with a bunch of particulars, okay? So these particulars are like pieces, since we're working with a picture motif here that's made up of pieces. That's like a puzzle, okay? And the problem is for most Christians, their puzzle is in a pile of pieces at their feet. That is, they've never, ever assembled the puzzle in a coherent whole, so they see the big picture. They never see the forest, so they're completely lost in the trees. Now, they may love the Lord, and they get enough of the basic parts right that they don't, that they know the Lord, they're regenerate, they're walking with the Lord, they're being productive in the kingdom, but they just don't get the big thing. And this makes it difficult for them to solve some problems, like the problem of evil, or why Jesus is the only way of salvation, and that kind of thing. But there's other problems, too. If your puzzle is in pieces, in a pile, first of all, since you never put it together, you don't know if you're missing any important pieces. Mm-hmm. You put a puzzle together, you're saying, oh, man, the middle's gone. Where did those pieces go, you know?
Yeah.
Or, since this is a metaphor for worldviews, there are other competitor worldviews that have their own pieces, and sometimes the pieces from other worldviews get mixed in with ours, and Christians don't realize it. I don't know if you've ever talked to a Christian who said they believed in reincarnation, but I know such a person has never put his puzzle together because there is no place for that puzzle piece to fit in Christianity. Reincarnation does no work for us. It's like putting a carburetor on a computer, you know? And so consequently, there's this confusion. Or maybe they'll be drawn into some other worldview that has a lot of Christian pieces that have been stolen from ours, the words and the names and like New Age. And they think, oh, that's the Christian story when it's a completely different story. And this is why I think this metaphor of a picture with pieces and a puzzle is so helpful to understand how worldviews work.
Yeah, and in the book, and you just mentioned it as well, most Christians never put the pieces together, and therefore they don't know whether they're missing pieces or not. Now, maybe this is a little tangential
works.
But isn't it tangential? Yeah, tangential. Anyway.
It's a bit tangy.
What I'm curious what your take is on why that's the case. Why would the majority of Christians never put the pieces together?
Well, this, I guess you could say, I mean, in a broad statement, it's a failure of the local church at some level, okay? But this may go back a long time. You know, we generally speaking, Christians are not catechized in their faith, with exceptions like the Reformed tradition. They're catechized. Christians are catechized. Christians who are catechized, that is, where they have a series of theological questions whose answers they've memorized that work them through, like the Westminster Catechism or the Heidelberg or any of a number of them, then they have a foundation laid that allows them to see the big picture. But this is to this is too much work for most Christians, and we're just into loving Jesus, you know. And so we've been influenced by the relativistic culture and the emotive culture, and we don't realize that by putting the time in these other things, this deepens us in a profound fashion, okay? And so I think that's part of it. It's amazing to me, Brett. I honestly, when I would teach this material, and we did it for years under another name called Credo, but when I teach this material at a church, I'd always cringe a little bit before I start. I'm thinking, I'm being sheepish. I'm thinking, oh, man, they're going to hear this stuff and say, I know that stuff. That's basic. That's so basic. Why is this guy coming in from somewhere to teach us this basic stuff? But I promise you, I do the presentation. I go through God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection in a coherent way. I tell the story of reality. And people all the time, they come up to me and they say, why hasn't anyone ever told me this story like this before? So I think it's a function of the culture.
Yeah, and I think that actually the story of reality, as you've laid it out, actually can offer a corrective, especially as we get into part one of this. But before we jump there, there's actually an excerpt I wanted to read from page 27 that I just really love how you put this. And I actually think that this, for Christians, evangelicals broadly speaking, this is a huge appeal to your book. But you write this on page at the bottom of page 27. The Christian story is like many other great stories in that it deals with the great issues all people struggle with and the great questions everyone asks. It's a story about peace shattered by rebellion, about love and betrayal, about self-sacrifice, and about redemption. All of our deepest aspirations, all of our longings, all of our hopes, and even our struggles, all of the conflicts in all of history are tied to this story. And that's a great way to that doesn't sound like systematic theology to me, okay? And, you know, one thing that J.P. Moreland talks about in his book, The Kingdom Triangle, is the need for drama. And what you captured so beautifully there is the drama of the story. So, yes, it's the story of reality. It captures the truth about all reality. But this is a dramatic tale that is compelling and persuasive, and the way you describe it there, it's like, I want to go see that movie, right?
And, well, that's sweet. But, you know, there's one other thing hidden in there that I want to mention, and that is the last line, however I put it. This is what all the other stories are all about.
All the conflicts and all of history are all tied
and all
to the story.
They're all tied to the story.
Yeah.
So when people write, they write great literature, they do movies, and it's a great movie. It is great because there is something deep down inside of us that is there's a memory of this big story, and it resonates with that deep down inside of us. The redemptive themes. Oh, this is a movie about redemption. Well, why is that important to people? Yeah. You know, this is a movie about coming of age or something like that. And well, gee, all of these things, I think that they're appealing because there's something deep down inside of us where there is a story, eternity written in our hearts, that these other stories, artistically done, resonate with in part, but deep down inside, this is the story that all of these are about and all the conflicts of history ultimately are about.
Mm-hmm. And so the I think the need for drama kind of within human beings fits nicely with the way that you've written this, because it's not just this is true, we can prove it, here's premise one, premise two, conclusion, but you've written in a way that's very compelling, particularly in an age where we are so visually driven, and stories have a very strong appeal. Right. And, you know, especially in my work with young people, which, I mean, you don't do anymore.
Only when I have to.
You've captured this beautifully for a young person who will not necessarily sit there and be compelled by me saying, okay, here's where we start in our theology. We start with, you know, God and who God is and his attributes and these kinds of things. But you talk about a story where there's, creation, there's conflict, the fall, there's a redemption, there's a rescue plan. And I think putting it in those terms and helping our not just our young people, but our adults see the drama in this story as well is very needed in this day and age. So, I loved that paragraph in the book.
Thanks.
Okay, I want to get into part one, I want to look at chapter three and chapter four really quickly here.
This is still part of the first
section. Laying the groundwork. And because of the culture, because of the relativism, because of the confusion within the church and without, mm-hmm. these chapters are so important. And so the chapter three is the true story. And I think this question of can we know it? How do we know even what we know, and can we know really the story of reality? Mm-hmm. So lay a little bit of that groundwork. Tell us.
Sure. I mean, there's a popular trend nowadays, especially in the university, ironically, that you can't know anything. So you spend a lot of time and money to hear a professor tell you can't know anything. There is no knowledge kind of deal. It's just story. It's just everybody's own narrative, you know.
Yeah, it costs a lot to find out that you don't know anything.
That's right. And say, I want my money back, you know, some people are saying. But what I wanted to show is that I wanted to speak to that. I wanted to speak to that question in people's mind. Can you really know the true story? And my point is, look, we are truth seekers by nature, and we are constantly testing the world to find out what's true about it. In fact, if we couldn't know what was true about the world, at least in some foundational ways, we'd be dead in a day. Then I give an illustration about this marvelous invention called a map. And when I went to Washington D.C. with my D.C. with my family, and you've been there before, you know the city's laid out like a maze. It's like the spokes of a wheel, and they're all broken spokes. I mean, really hard to get around that city. But we did fine because we used this remarkable invention. Well, do you ever think about what you do when you use a map or GPS or anything like that? When you use a map, the map is a claim about the way the world is, in this case, the topography, the streets, etc. And you find where the map says you are here kind of thing, and then you find your destination, and then you use the map to find your way to your destination. And, generally, you're successful. And by the way, if you're not successful, that is, if there's a mistake, you learn it soon enough, and you make adjustments for it. You drive, and you arrive. Now, this is a very simple little illustration. I could choose a whole bunch of different ones, but where we are actually testing out the way the world really is. And we discover that in some cases, in many cases, our beliefs about the way the world is are accurate. That is, we do know some things, and we know that we know them. Now, of course, finding your way around Washington, D.C. and figuring out the meaning of the universe are two different things, admittedly, on scale. But it ought to, I think, parry at least the doubts that these are things we could never know about. We have tools that we use all the time and we are familiar with to learn truths about the world. And I submit in the book that these are some of the tools are ones that we can use to figure out the story. Some of the things we can learn on our own. Mm-hmm. The hints are all around us. Some of the things the author has to tell us, and that's okay. But between the two of them, I think we can get the story pretty straight.
Yeah, and what you're talking about is correspondence.
That's right.
And but again, this is where I think we have to put these handles on these ideas for people.
Right.
We can talk about the correspondence theory of truth, and that's all good, but the map analogy, map illustration helps people to see, mm-hmm. this is kind of what we do all of the time. And in addition, and there's kind of two parts to the knowing, I think, that you really capture well, is not only the idea of the correspondence, you know, this story corresponds to reality, but also the coherence.
Yeah.
And that's a huge part here.
Yeah.
And I think this is actually really helpful given a secular culture mm-hmm. that doesn't know the big picture. And they pull these, especially kind of your skeptics and mm-hmm. atheists who pull these little pieces out
right.
and hold them up and say, this doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do here is really kind of a helping us to see how this coheres, how the story coheres, mm-hmm. makes sense of the small pieces. And that's one of the other ways.
Well, this is really important because one of a recent interview, and in my book, the story itself starts with God. And in the interview, the woman asked me, she's friendly, but she's anticipating the skeptic. And she said, well, the skeptic's going to say, I don't believe in God. I said, well, this kind of misses the point. You know, Tolkien starts his magnificent four-book series that ends up with the ring and all of that. But like this, in a hole in the ground lived a hobbit. That's his first line. Now, what if you said, I don't know what a hobbit is, and I don't think I even believe in those hobbits. And what Tolkien's going to say is, sit down and relax and just let the story unfold, okay? That's all I'm asking of the critic. Don't tell me I don't believe in God. I don't care whether you believe in God or not. I don't care. Read the story. Because part of what I think makes the biblical story compelling is this particular point you brought up, Brett, is that it's coherent. It holds together in a marvelous way. It not only has explanatory power, correspondence, uh-huh. It's the best explanation for the way things are, but there's an internal unity that turns out to solve a lot of problems, like the problem of evil and like why Jesus is the only way, which are other gripes that skeptics have. Let's take a look at the whole story. Just set judgment aside for a moment and hear what the story has to say. And then we can talk about those other things. I have a feeling when people go, and this is not a trick. It's not a rhetorical trick, you know. I think that when people see how the whole thing holds together, that there is a certain persuasiveness in the coherence itself.
Mm-hmm. And in chapter four, you talk about obstacles. And you talk, you know, one of the things that you address is how nothing really gets solved by getting rid of God. And that's kind of a standard move in this.
Well, particularly with the problem of evil.
Right.
Right.
Right. And I actually, I think there's, as I was reading chapter four, I just thought, man, there's apologetic value. And I think, how did you describe it? Would you say soft apologetics?
I just made that up. Soft apologetics, right.
Yeah, but I think that's one of the great values in the book as well, because there's, I mean, I guess I would say there's a deft touch here where, and this is where, you know, you have your traditional apologetic books, mm-hmm. which are very helpful, of course.
And we all learn from.
Exactly.
And we write some of them.
Exactly. And they kind of take issues head on. And I think there's room for more work in mm-hmm. apologetics and other kinds of work. And this is one of them mm-hmm. where you've woven apologetics kind of throughout the mm-hmm. story, which is desperately needed in this day and age, because we can't just tell the story. Mm-hmm. We also have to help kind of narrate for people how this fits together.
Right. And so, I owe that to Lewis, too. He does it so well. And yeah. I copied him in that regard.
Well, okay. So let's get into part one. This section is God, starting in chapter 6. Mm-hmm. And you say that Genesis 1:1. We're just rolling here. All right, well, let's roll.
We got a 27, I don't know, 23, I don't know.
Okay.
We're rolling. It's going fast, bro. I'm having a great time with you. I know.
I knew you would. now, you say in Genesis 1:1 is the second greatest line in the whole story.
Right. In my view.
Why is that?
It's pretty great.
So why is that?
Well, it's the second greatest line because it is a really great line, but there's another line that I think is greater, and maybe we'll get to that. But this is pretty great. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's how our story starts, okay? And the start of a story always lays the foundation of the main characters and what the nature of reality is. So just think of the hobbit, for example. In a hole, in a ground, lived a hobbit. Okay? Wow, this isn't our world. This is a different world, you know? Okay, well, then you get in that world, you get used to that world. And there's a certain sense, even though this story is about our world, there's a lot of people who don't think it is. And so I'm just saying, well, here's how we start, and notice how the foundation is laid. God created the heavens and the earth. Notice in this story, we got two kinds of things. We have physical things, and we have non-physical things. We got God. He's not physical, but he makes a world that is physical. You got physical and non-physical things, and the non-physical thing, God, made everything else. That's like an act of power. Well, if God can make the whole universe, gee, we shouldn't be surprised to find, like, water turning into wine later on in the story, or people right. being raised from the dead. This all fits. And some people think these are bizarre. I said, you can't disqualify the details of one story based on a commitment to a different story. That's what the materialists, the atheists do all the time. Oh, that doesn't happen. Well, it doesn't happen in your world, but it does happen in this world.
And Christians make the same mistake. I will hear Christians who will say, yeah, we do believe all this kind of illogical stuff like virgin birth and, you know, water into wine. And I think what it betrays is their lack of knowledge, depth, grounding in this particular issue issue of God. So I actually, as you were, as I was reading through, you know, chapter 6 and 7 and 8 and just all of part 1, it struck me. I've been thinking a lot about this because one thing I've been thinking about in particular is how, you know, we make these appeals to the Bible as the Word of God. And I often find that it doesn't take with a lot of young people. It's just a mere assertion.
Right.
And they're lacking this important foundation. And that's what you lay. And that's why this is the, you know, such an important line, because you lay this foundation and it changes the nature of the universe. It's a theistic universe.
That's
and so
right.
I think this is so important.
Exactly. And boy, underscore, exclamation point, you know, emoji, whatever. You know, it is so critical. Our world is a world that has physical and non-physical things. It is alive with a spiritual realm and with powers that are beyond what the five senses can perceive. That is the nature of our world, okay? And all throughout the story, you have details like that. Now, there are good reasons to believe that this is the kind of world we live in. I'm not arguing for that at this moment. There's some soft apologetics here and there to kind of make the case. But I want people to see that this is the world we're presenting as real, and make no mistake about it. So when Christopher Hitchens goes to when he's in a debate with Jay Richards, and he says, interrupts him and says, do you believe in the resurrection? Jay said, yes. He said, well, I rest my case. What do you mean, rest your case? Of course he believes in the resurrection. That's what this debate is all about, the kind of world that we actually live in. So this is circular reasoning on Chris Hitchens' part. Yes, those things fit in our world, and there's nothing unusual about it, so they can't decide the debate just because we believe something that's odd in your world.
And you talk about, and I think Nancy Piercy in her intro,
Thank you, Nancy. She's fabulous and does a great introduction to the book.
And she talks about Schaefer saying, we often start with, you know, Jesus died on the cross for your sins, and we actually need to go back to, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth.
Why was that even necessary? Right.
Yeah, and but if you look at much of contemporary evangelicalism and our message and how we have pitched the gospel, it starts with love or forgiveness or God loves you and has a kind of a wonderful plan for your life. And so I think this point of God is the foundation, and starting there and putting that necessary foundation down is maybe a corrective for evangelical church today.
And I have a gentle correction on that phrase you just stated. I say it's not about God's plan for our lives. It's about our lives for God's wonderful plan. That's the right order in my view now. And God is first. He's the main character, and the story is about his purposes in the world, not ours.
Now, just a practical question here, because as I'm thinking about this, how do we – are there ways that you would suggest the church kind of reorient their people? We are in this very narcissistic, individualistic culture that focuses and orients us to ourselves, and so the church influenced tries to make an appeal on a very individualistic kind of consumer kind of approach. We want to reorient people, and we talk about, hey, it doesn't start with you or me, it starts with God. Are there any practical thoughts on that?
Well, it's a simple thing I've done lots of times in churches, okay? I said, look, the book of Hebrews was written to suffering Christians. The book of 1 Peter was written to suffering Christians. The book of 1 Thessalonians written to suffering Christians. 2 Thessalonians written to suffering Christians. Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 2 Timothy written by Paul from prison. Wow, that's a pretty big chunk there. That ought to give us an idea of what the emphasis is in our story if we're reading it in a balanced way. We are, Paul says in Philippians, if I am to be sacrificed or offered up as a drink offering on the sacrifice of your faith, I rejoice. Hmm. Paul himself knew that he was expendable for the story, if you will, for God's purposes. And that's the kind of thing I think that needs to be emphasized. And it's all there right in the first verse. In the beginning, God created.
Now, there are, of course, alternatives to our story. Yeah. The skeptic's going to come back and say, yeah, there's different options. You actually cover two of those, and I think you put them in a helpful way to remember them. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about matterism and mindism.
Right. In our story, two things are real, visible things and invisible things, okay? It's interesting, the two major competing stories go to one extreme or the other of that equation. So probably the most well-known competitor is the view that says only matter exists, or molecules in the universe with energy following natural law. It's known as materialism. That's the fancy-schmancy word philosophers use. I just call it matterism, okay, because matter, it's godism or matterism. It's one alternative. And then I talk about this is the view that atheists hold. Their story starts in the beginning. The particles, or as one famously put it, the cosmos is all there is, ever was, or ever will be. Okay, Carl Sagan. And so that's one option. And then I talk about, all right, but that doesn't tell the whole story. This leaves out some stuff that everybody else knows is real. And I talk a little bit about the problems with that. It's inadequacies. I said, well, you can go the other direction. You could say, no, it's not matter, and that's the only thing that exists. It's mind that's the only thing that exists, a cosmic mind. And here I'm talking about some Eastern religions and certainly the New Age and all the permutations of that, that the physical world is just an illusion, Maya, and we have to get back to the Godhead because we're all ultimately God in the long run. And that's filled with all of its own problems, too. I mean, when we think, oh, I'm God, that's cool. And really what they mean is, no, God is God and you're not anything. Mm-hmm. You're just a figment of God's imagination is what it amounts to. And so that doesn't sound so good when you get down to the nitty-gritty. So I talk about those two as competitors, either God and matter, or matter only, or God mind only, not the kind of God that we talk about, just this personal mind. And so those are the two major competitors, the way I've laid it out.
Yeah. Okay, so we got this important foundation of God. Part two, you get to man.
Right.
Now, if we start with God as the foundation, the story's not about us, it's about him. Does that somehow undermine our specialness? Because I think that's kind of the skeptic yeah. might look at it that way.
Right. It doesn't undermine our specialness. Some people want to make man into a god, okay? No, man's not God. He's a creature, okay? But he's not junk either. And so in a certain sense, the mindism, man is God. Materialism, man is junk. No. Human beings are creatures, but they also have an invisible self, which it's by itself doesn't make it unique. Human beings have souls, but so do other sentient creatures. It's the kind of souls that humans have. We bear the mark of God. And so because we bear the mark of God, this sets us apart from everything else, gives us infinite value. It grounds all the moral obligations we have towards each other, and it puts us in a position to have a friendship with God, which is what God created for us for in the beginning.
But that's not the whole story. That's one side of the coin.
That's right. And I call that the beauty of man. So man is beautiful, okay? Schaefer called it the nobility, I think, or the dignity of man. But then there's something else. And, of course, we all know this is true. We all know that there's something special about human beings, okay? But we also know there's something else. Like, we're something gone wrong. We're broken. And we're not just broken like a machine is broken. We're bad. There's something evil that lurks inside of us. And then I give the accounting of how that actually took place. There's another spiritual force that tempted Adam and Eve to rebel against their maker. And when they obeyed him, that changed everything. They broke the world. I mean, I want to say that again, because when I stumbled across that, I thought, this is a great way of putting it. That makes sense to me. When they disobeyed God, Adam and Eve broke the world. And there are lots of consequences to that: slavery, debt of sin, the fact that they're now caught, they're slave to Satan, they're slave to their flesh, and the king is mad, and he ought to be mad. So this brings up now the fall of man. So now he's in a big problem. So now what? And this is where God steps in to initiate a rescue plan.
Now connect for us why we're responsible. I mean, this is a big question. Why are we responsible? Adam and Eve broke the world. They did it. So why am I responsible for
that? This one's a little harder, and I do give some time to this, mm-hmm. and because people are going to raise the why am I responsible for what Adam did? And I guess there's a couple of ways to respond to this, but I'll just give you the most common way. Ancient people understood that no man is an island entire unto himself. He's part of the whole. And so when families act, or when villages act, or when nations act, they act for the whole. And so when one nation goes to war against another nation, it might be the president that makes the declaration or the Congress, but the whole people are involved. And by the same token, we have a federal head in Adam, and we are his. We are of his race, of his country, as it were. And when he declared war on God, he declared war for the rest of us, and we have happily, as it turns out, followed in his pattern and continued the rebellion against God. So therefore, not just Adam and Eve are guilty, but we're guilty as well.
And these two pieces, beautiful and broken, have that explanatory power.
Oh, yes.
That matterism and mindism don't have.
No, that's a very good point. Remember I said, everybody knows that human beings are beautiful in some sense. We're special. This is why we tell our kids, don't treat each other like animals. This is why we gas termites, but we're not supposed to gas Jews, all right? There's a difference, and the difference matters. We also know something's wrong. Now, this is something we know about other people, but we try to hide it about ourselves. Well, he's messed up, but I'm okay and you're so-so, you know, kind of deal, or really bad. But we all know inside there's something wrong. So I'm making an appeal here in the story to things we already know about ourselves, but the story has explanatory power. It helps us to understand why it is the way it is. Okay, and this adds persuasive quality to it.
Yeah, and it just occurred to me, we start with Jesus and sin, but you will hear skeptics or unbelievers who think their perception is that the Christian message is that humanity is bad and worthless. And I wonder if that has to do with our overemphasis on kind of the brokenness and fall of man, yeah. and not starting with mm-hmm. God and the foundation and in right in that first chapter, mm-hmm. made in God's image. Mm. And I think because we want to say, well, there's the brokenness, certainly, mm-hmm. which we all recognize, but there's also the beauty and the nobility and the dignity, which
That's
we all
right.
recognize.
Yeah,
as well.
I want to say something about that, but I'm looking at the clock and I just realized this is our show. So we don't have to be constrained by the clock. We can keep going if we wanted to. Sure, why not? Okay, well then we're gonna do what you want to do up to the top of the hour, and this can play on the markets, and then we'll pick up from there, you and I, and this will be posted so other people can go back to the website and catch the whole thing.
Because yeah. this is my show, so I think I'll make that decision.
There you go, and. So what I wanted to say about that, I'm sorry, remind me of the point that you were just...
So I was thinking maybe sometimes...
Well, the way people think about the human race being bad or whatever. Whenever
right.
you look at the human race, you have to take multiple looks. You have to look at human beings made in the image of God. Good. Remarkable. But then you have to look at human beings fallen. Bad. You know, so when people say... And then when with Christians, then you see redeemed. So you have these different aspects. And if people ask me, are human beings basically good or basically bad? I say, well, it kind of depends what you mean. They are made out of good stuff, but they went bad. And now the bad rules their behavior. But since they're made out of good stuff, and this is something from Schaefer, it gives us hope that we can get back to that good thing. Mm-hmm. If we were started out bad to begin with, if that was bad was our essential nature, then how are you going to change that? So this gives us hope because we know where we came from. We can go back to there if God helps us.
And there is no other worldview that offers anything like this in terms of an explanation that really a comprehensive explanation for human nature.
I agree.
And again, this is part of the apologetic value of this approach. The coherence of it and the explanatory power is very powerful apologetically. Now, chapter 15 is entitled Wrath, which no one really wants to talk about, right?
Right.
I mean, no, God is love, so no one talks about wrath. In fact, you talk about it. The idea is repugnance.
Yes.
To Christians. And so how does explain, fit this into the story for us? Because I think it's an important piece that many Christians are not quite sure how to fit this piece in.
Well, I think it becomes easier to countenance when we, reflect on ourselves in circumstances where we see some egregious evil take place. Some person has fomented or has perpetrated an egregious evil. And just think of a rape of a friend or the torture of a child or something like that. And when you countenance the action, what is it that rises up inside of you? There is an anger that's there that is appropriate to the circumstance. You are mad because this isn't the way things are supposed to be. And you're not just mad in the abstract because they're not the way they're supposed to be, but that person has done something he or she should not have done, and they are guilty, and they are worthy of being punished for that action, okay? I think that's an intuition, a moral intuition that we all have built into us, which strikes me as another example of the image of God in man. This is something we have the apparatus, Brett, that's part of our human nature to find, in a certain sense, common cause thematically with these things. So here is God being angry. He made the world perfect. Everything he made was just right. They were naked and not ashamed. And what did they do? They messed it all up. They broke their friendship with God. They betrayed the trust of a father. They rebelled against a sovereign. Well, when you start thinking of it in those terms, you realize the terror. Look at what people think about an individual example of evil that makes them really angry. That's just a byproduct, one example of billions of examples that are byproducts of this one act of rebellion. That's how bad that was, and that made the king angry.
And I think it's good to pull up those examples, to give some of those clear case examples, because I think in a morally relativistic kind of age, you need to do some work dredging up the intuitions.
Right. Yeah.
So dredge up some of the intuitions, and so you go from man. I mean, from God to man, you get into to Jesus, the rescue, and then the resurrection, and the happily ever after. So we've given
for some,
not
for
that's
everybody.
Right, exactly. And that, so we've given you a taste of the story of reality. You need to get the book now, so you can kind of see how this one ends and how it all fits together. The book is a story of reality, how the world began, how it ends, and everything important that happens in between.
Available at str.org.
Written by the boss, Greg Kokel. Yeah. Go to str.org, buy that, get that, read it, and reread it. Greg, this was, I have to admit, this is the best interview I've ever done. Thank you. you've been listening to Stand to Reason. I'm Brett Kunkel with my good friend and colleague, Greg Kokel. We'll see you next time on Stand to Reason. All right, so we're going to wrap this up by getting to the other parts, which are important. And as you're listening to this, you can kind of see the pieces kind of falling into place. So God's the foundation. We get to man. This is where we get to the problem. We get to the fall. Then in part three, we get to Jesus. And now we look at in chapter 16, you look at history, which is it's not. You kind of go beyond a little bit of the storytelling here.
Right.
Why did you feel the need to include chapter 16?
Well,
it's not about the story kind of per se, but...
Yes, because it is not a part of the story, but it is about the story. And at the beginning, I mentioned this is the story of reality. Okay, well, that means the details of the story actually took place, that the people in the story really existed, and the events really happened or are going to happen in some case. What I am talking about is history, not fantasy. But when it comes to the life of Jesus, who is the central player in the whole story, obviously, I mean, this is I'm going to say the crux, but I'm pausing because, am I going to use a pun here? I don't mean it to be a pun, but he's the crux. He's the hinge pin, so to speak, of the whole thing, the foundation of the rescue plan. There are people that take exception with the details of the account of the life of Jesus of Nazareth. And if Jesus is not a real player in history, or he is a kind of a player, but he wasn't the kind of guy that was described in the story itself, in the primary source documentation that the story comes from, in our case, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, well, then we got no story. We're back to fantasy land again. And so I take some time to talk about that particular question. How many people think Jesus is just a rehashed dying and rising God of ancient Middle Eastern lore, and I call it the recycled Redeemer. And this is so popular with people nowadays. It's a stunner. I had to address it because if I didn't address it there, nobody would take anything else. People who are taken in by this notion would not take any more of the broader story seriously. And then after I dispatched that, and it's in a certain sense it's easily dispatchable because there's not a shred of truth to any of it. Okay, then I say, well, what are the What do the real historians have to say? And then I mention something about the craft of history, and I'm trying to restore people's confidence in the salient details of the gospel narrative. These things really happen, and historians don't think that Jesus was a myth. That's drivel to them. Historians don't think that everything written in the gospel was a rehashing of ancient mystery religions. No, they think there are lots of things in there that you can count on. In fact, taken on the main, they think that the gospels taken on a whole, as a whole, are reliable. So I needed to address that particular issue before I got in to the particulars of the person of Jesus of Nazareth and why he was so important in the story.
And I just have to reiterate, this is the value, I think, one of the values of this book is that as you're telling the story, you're kind of then pulling back with the reader and help, and through this, you're reminding us, hey, this is the story of reality. Mm-hmm. This is the true story of reality. And here you go. Here, this is grounded in history. So this is a tremendous value in this book, kind of over and against other kind of narrative theologies or other mm-hmm. ways that kind of popular writers have captured this. So I think these things, and that's why I want to highlight that, because I think this is so valuable. Then we get into chapter 17 and 18, the God-man and the rescue, which is, of course, with our theme for the Rethink Conference last year in Southern California
and
Dallas.
Who is Jesus, right?
We look at who is Jesus, and what we focus on are these two chapters. And looking at Jesus' identity, why is his identity so important to understand at this part of the story?
Yeah. Well, there are two things, and this helps to keep it structurally simple. There's two things that one needs to get right about Jesus. And these things really have very little to do with his teachings in general. That is, if you're really taking with the teachings of Jesus, but you miss these two things, you miss the whole thing. You miss the real important stuff, okay? And that is who Jesus was and what he came to do. Who Jesus was and what he came to do. Theologians call it the person and the work of Christ, okay? So who was Jesus? And this is where it gets to the identity issue, because Jesus is absolutely unique in terms of religious leaders. Religious leaders brought a system of theology. They brought a body of teaching. And the body of teaching and the theology was different from themselves. They were the messenger, the prophet, or whatever. So if you took the messenger out of the religion, you'd still have the body of teaching, all right? It doesn't matter what religion it happens to be. That's the case. If you take Jesus out of Christianity, you do not have Christianity, because there's no body of teaching that makes it what it is. Jesus is the center. He is the person it is about. And as it turns out, he drew attention to himself, not to his teaching. You think of his major claims. Think, I am the resurrection and the life. I am the bread of life. I am the living water. You know, I am the Alpha and the Omega. You know, unless you believe that I am, you will die in your sins. And when it came around time for his trial, he is executed not for what he did, but for who he claimed to be. Are you the Christ, the Son of God? You have said it yourself. And so that sealed his doom. Jesus is the center focus. And the reason is because only man... A way of putting it is this: man was guilty, man owed the debt, only man could do what man needed to do, but only God was capable of doing it. Now, this takes some explanation. It's in the book, but I'm just summing it up now.
This is why you need the God-man.
This is exactly why you need the God-man. Why the God-man? Because man owed, man had to pay, but only God had the resources to pay. And so, and this is why, if we don't let Jesus do the paying, then we have to pay for ourselves, and that'd take forever.
Yeah, and this is another thing that I think is such a helpful corrective. And I mean, I hate to beat up on the church, but I think many of us feel like the church's teaching, the current kind of evangelical church's teaching, has been inadequate. And you see, I think you talk about the focus on the identity, not the teachings. And oftentimes we invert that. And there's so much focus on Jesus' teachings and kind of what he did in terms of what he did morally, the focus on social justice,
helping the poor,
loving your neighbor, which are all important things. But and so often people don't understand, Christians don't understand the identity. When you talk to them, well, when I go and I'll role play a Mormon with Christians, one of the things I'll do is I'll kind of attack the deity of Christ and the nature of God, and the vast majority of Christians cannot explain that.
Yeah.
They don't know it, and they certainly don't know where it is in Scripture.
So
this is a huge deficiency, and so I think that's one reason why so many Christians can't get beyond Jesus loves you and died on the cross for your sins. And that's the explanation.
Just think of you just made reference to the second great commandment, you know, loving your neighbor. It's curious that almost everybody who reads the parable of the Good Samaritan gets it wrong, because it comes right after the loving your neighbor, and people think, well, Jesus is teaching us to love our neighbor, and the Samaritan is an example of that. That is not how it happened. Jesus was asked, what are the greatest commandments? In other words, keep these commandments, and you really kept the greatest ones. He said, love the Lord your God with your whole heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Okay? Now, I'm going to tell you, Brett, and I say it in the book, there has not been an instant in my entire life where I've ever kept either of those commandments. All right? This is not a help. This is a hindrance. Jesus is saying, you want to go that way? Nice guy? Good guy? No, this is not going to work. Okay? But somebody wasn't quite convinced. And so he figured he'd got the loving God thing okay, but I don't know about loving my neighbor. And so here's what he said: seeking to justify himself, he asked, who is my neighbor? And then Jesus told the account of the Good Samaritan and basically says, your neighbor is your greatest enemy. You have to love your greatest enemy. That's what's required if you go on your own. So even in the case of loving your neighbor, the point was Jesus was trying to frustrate our abilities to self-justify, and was trying to force us in the position like the Pharisee in the back of the synagogue beating his breast saying, God, have mercy on me. Not the Pharisee, but the tax gatherer. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. That's what he's after.
So this takes us right into part four in the cross. Take us beyond Jesus died on the cross for our sins. Why an entire section? Why multiple chapters on the cross?
Well, I wanted people to understand what was actually going on. When when people say, when Christians say Jesus died on a cross for sin, this is kind of has a slogan quality to it. Now, it is entirely true, as put. My concern is a lot of non-Christians don't make sense of that, and I don't think many Christians understand it. And so I talked about the trade, okay? I talked about the brutality of crucifixion and physically what what happened during a crucifixion. But you know what? That physical torment, which is unbelievable from our perspective, that happened to lots of people. Man, a lot of people got crucified back then, and a lot of Christians after the time of Jesus. So it wasn't like being crucified and whipped and scourged and beaten and all of those things. All the mistreatment of man to man was unique to Jesus. It was important, but it wasn't unique. What was unique was what happened on the cross in the 3 hours that darkness shrouded it, Calvary, and God the Father poured out all of his anger and wrath upon his son Jesus as if Jesus were guilty of an unpardonable sin. And why punish the evil? Why punish the perfect one, you know, the one who'd never did any sin? And the answer is that in a certain fashion, the crimes, the list of our crimes, Paul says this in Colossians 3, the certificate of our debts was nailed to Jesus' cross in the supernatural realm, so to speak. And he's making reference to actually something we see in the book of Revelation. The books are opened, and people are judged according to their deeds from the books. In other words, God is making a list, and he's checking it twice. And so when we go to the final judgment there, the books of death are opened. And these are the ones that condemn us because we see the record of our own crimes against God. He doesn't miss anything. And these are the things that deserve for us the guilty judgment, okay? But Jesus took that rap sheet nailed to his cross, and he took it on himself. And so when he said at the end of the ordeal, it is finished, it's the Greek word, tetelestai. It's the same word that was used to cancel out debts in the ancient world. It's over with. It wasn't just that not over with like, I'm glad that's done with. But the debt is over with. It's paid. It's fulfilled. It's completed. It was a victory cry for Jesus. And that marks the great exchange. That marks the trade. Jesus took our sins upon himself before the Father so that we could take his goodness. He traded his life for ours. And this, by the way, is why Jesus is the only way of salvation. Because he's the only one who solved the problem. He's the only one who did what needed to be done to rescue us. No other man did this, no other man could, and without him, we are lost, crushed by our own overwhelming weight of guilt. And everyone's going to have to then pay for their own crimes against God, and that would take forever.
And that's another way I think this story form, this narrative form, helps to answer these challenges, the challenge to exclusivism. And so, again, so valuable. And I think part four, these three chapters on the cross are so needed because, and I guess part of it is thinking in my context with young people, and as I sit down with young people, I work with them, I talk to them, and you hear they are unable to get beyond the cliche, Jesus died on the cross for my sin. And then we wonder why there's such a lack of passion for their faith, because there is hardly any content to their faith. And why don't our young people, when we have a passionate worship band, a talented worship band that's leading in worship, and you watch young people just stand there, blank stares, not singing, not engaged. And one of the things that I think we need to do is to give them this kind of content so they have a deep understanding of the cross and what it means. What you just did right there is you took us deeper into the meaning of the cross and understanding of it, and then the response then can come from us as we recognize the what we can be thankful for, the depth of thankfulness, our brokenness, our sinfulness, this great gift, and it ultimately leads to a deeper worship.
Right, and I put a handle on it to help it for explanatory power. I just call it the trade. And if you think about the trade, you don't have to think about substitutionary atonement. You don't have to think about propitiation. You don't have to think about justification. Okay, these are all appropriate terms that are used to describe it. But there's a complexity there that we don't need right now. What I just want you to do is see the trade, because that's what these terms are referring to. You see the trade. He gets our sin. We get his righteousness. That means God's not mad at us anymore, which, wow, when that sinks in, this could be life transforming. And all of this is free. It can't be bought. It can't be earned. It can only be received with a humble act of trust. And this is what the story calls faith.
And this is where the drama gets so kind of climactic, mm-hmm. right? And in so many stories, you know, this is the part where the person who gives their life for someone yeah. else, we see this kind of theme resonates with humanity. And so the Christian story is so dramatic here. And then we get to part five. Mm-hmm. We get to resurrection. Chapter 22, again, I think that soft apologetic comes in here, which is really important. You talk about the four facts for the historical resurrection of right. Jesus. Just give us a brief glimpse on, because I think there's a big question for a lot of people today with kind of the skepticism and the undermining of knowledge. How do we recover history? How do we reconstruct history? You kind of help, I think, people do that.
Well, historians have a way of doing this. They don't examine things directly like a chemist does. You know, they have to determine the facts of the past indirectly by the evidence that's left behind. J. Warner Wallace, obviously a good friend of ours, former Stand to Reason staffer and speaker, detective. Well, it's detective work. It just reaches further back than even his cold cases do. Not 20 to 30 years, but maybe 300, 400, 1,000, 2,000 years. But still, the principle is the same. They have to work with evidence from which they infer certain information. And the different types of historical evidence are more compelling than others. So if you have written sources and you have multiple written sources, for example, that give information about the same event, so there's attestation there. If the sources are early, that is, if they're closer to the event that took place, they're more trustworthy. If there's archaeological evidence that corroborates that kind of thing, well, that's great, too. If these written testimonies seem like the testimony of people who was actually there and were in a position to observe, eyewitness, well, that's even better. If you have hostile witness, it's kind of like where even the people who are inclined to be against you are acknowledging the truthfulness of this event, that helps.
I use that criterion with my children all the time. I know,
are they the hostile witnesses?
Well, they're hostile to each other. So when they actually say something good about their brother or sister, I'm like, okay, that's probably reliable.
Yeah, that's probably right? reliable. There you go. Yeah. So with the same concept at work here, or embarrassing facts. If you have a testimony where somebody's saying something that is embarrassing to the person, well, they're not going to probably fabricate something that makes them look bad. So these are all details that go into the assessment of the trustworthiness of an ancient document. And, of course, the historians have done this to the Gospels, and they come out with flying colors. Now, this doesn't mean that every historian believes everything that's in the Gospels, because there's some things that are a little embarrassing for some folks, like resurrections and water into wine and virgin births and stuff like that. And it just doesn't fit well with their worldview. So they're going to look askance at that. Now, in particular, though, what's important is the resurrection of Christ. And here I trade, and the chapter is called Four Facts, because I'm trading on a methodology that Gary Habermas first introduced. And that is, let's just deal with the kind of facts regarding the resurrection that almost every single person in the business, every historian that deals with the life of Christ, virtually every single one of them acknowledges is reliable. And I'll give you the four. And there's one, they're all about like 98%. Okay, one of them is about 75%. But still, that's pretty darn good. Okay, here's the first one. Jesus died on a Roman cross. Okay, so you got this man, Jesus of Nazareth, that was executed. He's dead. Everybody agrees with that. All right. Secondly, the tomb that he was buried in was empty. Now, about 75% of all the scholars, I'm talking about 1,500 that Gary Habermas surveyed, of all stripes dealing with the historical Jesus. These are people who are in the know about these details. About three-quarters of them acknowledge that the tomb is empty. And there's a good reason that they would think it was empty, because this whole nonsense about Jesus rising from the dead could have been resolved very easily by just showing the body.
That's right. Not quite consensus, but still 75%.
Oh, yeah, but
fantastic.
Yeah, it's the safety in numbers here, okay? Yeah. And there's more reasons to believe that it's empty. I mean, and the 25 who maybe don't agree, those 75 are all over them, you know, because the evidence is so strong. Here's the third thing, is the disciples had an experience that they thought was the risen Christ. Everybody agrees to that. Nobody takes exception with that. And the final thing is, skeptics, two of them in particular, James, the half-brother of Jesus, also wrote the book of James, and Saul of Tarsus, a persecutor of the church. I mean, beyond being a skeptic, mm-hmm. he's a hostile. Both of them turned on a dime in virtue of, they thought, having been seen the resurrected Jesus, okay? So these are, notice that not a single thing I mentioned is supernatural. You got a dead guy, you got an empty tomb, you got a bunch of guys saying they saw something, and you got two people changing their point of view. Nothing supernatural about that. But you put those things all together and you ask, what is the best explanation for those facts? And the only thing that's going to fit them all is going to be what the disciples themselves said it was, and that is that Jesus, who was dead, who was crucified, has risen. And, well, maybe they're hallucinating. Look it. Hallucinations are what philosophers call first-person private, okay? What's that? That's when you go to sleep and have a great dream, and then you wake up. You don't tell your wife, honey, go to sleep with me and we'll both share the dream. Okay. It's in your head. It's not going to get into her head, okay? That kind of thing. That's the way hallucination is. But these guys all saw the same thing at the same time, multiple times, in multiple places, and talking, walking, eating, even some were doubtful. And they were still won over. And even the doubtful James and this, not just skeptic, but the persecutor of Christians, Paul of Tarsus, what best accounts for that? Saul of Tarsus. But I don't know. Aliens, right? Okay, you can do that if you want, but I think the smart money is on the resurrection. And that's the point that I make in the book.
And pulling back again with the foundation of God and with the foundation of a theistic worldview, this just fits well. This coheres the story and gives us the best explanation. Okay, Greg, with our remaining time here, tie this up. Kind of what's the happily ever after of the story? Is there a happily ever after?
There isn't. The so-called happily ever after of stories is called the denouement. It's when everything kind of comes together. But in our story, not everybody lives happily ever after, okay? Now, what I'm going to say, though, this part of the story is both the most popular and the most unpopular part of the story, okay? But I want to just backtrack a little bit, because at the beginning of the book, I talk about one of the most serious problems everybody knows needs to be resolved or dealt with by a worldview, and that is that everybody knows something's wrong with the world, the problem of evil, all right? Another thing that really troubles people about Christianity, that's one of them, is that Jesus is the only way of salvation. That really bugs them too, you know. What they don't realize, and nor do Christians, and this is a theme I developed throughout the book, that these things fit together. They are side by side. The problem of evil is not a problem for us. Our whole story is about the problem of evil. And it starts in the third chapter. It isn't until the end that it's resolved, but it is resolved. You see, our story is not over yet. It's part of our story. It's at home in our story, and our story is not over yet. Jesus comes and does the thing that no man could do who wasn't a God-man. He rescues us in a way that is capable of solving the problem. He's the only one who solved the problem. The solution comes in two stages, okay? The first stage of the solution is that he rescues guilty people. Peter says, 2 Peter, you know, people are saying, where's Jesus? Where's the promise of his coming? Well, he's not slow. as some people count slowness, Peter says. He's long-suffering, not willing that any should perish. So what Peter's saying, he's kind of waiting, because when he comes back, as Lewis puts it, when the author walks on the stage, the play's over, you know, okay? So if Jesus were to come right now, man, a lot of people would take gas for what they've done. Right now, it's time for mercy. But that time will run out. And when that time runs out, this first step, God offers mercy and forgiveness. Okay, and then when the time runs out, that's it. And then people get their due. Those who get mercy, they don't get their due. They get what Jesus bought for them. Jesus got their due. Those who don't take advantage of the mercy, they pay for what they did. And that's not a pretty story. You've got a pretty picture. You've got Revelations chapter 20 and the great white throne judgment. And I talk about the books that are open. I mentioned them earlier, the books of death, I call them. And then there's the books of life. And the books of life have the names of those who put their trust in the Savior. Those whose names are in the books of death, or whose names are not in the books of life, the deeds are in the books of death, those are judged according to their deeds, and they are punished forever. People wonder, when will justice finally be done? Okay, that guy got away with murder. No, he's not going to get away. There will be a final reckoning, but it won't be just for that guy. It's going to be for us, too. Unless we're rescued by the rescuer, okay? So God solves the problem of evil by punishing evil people. Justice is fulfilled. And then he transforms the world to make it perfect once again. Some would argue, because of the fact of evil in our history, that it's better than it ever could have been without evil in our history. That's one angle. He transforms everything into the kind of world that our hearts have always yearned for. And Lewis trades on this notion of longing, which I think is the most useful way to talk about heaven. You know, you look in Revelation, you see streets of gold, you know, emeralds and all this other stuff. That doesn't do much for me, personally. Crowns and all that. Yeah. But there's something else existentially that's happening, going to happen. That's what I focus on in the end, the reunion with all the saints that have gone before, family members, whatever, the resurrection to perfect bodies, the sense of being once and for all and completely clean. Who knows that? Who experiences that? You know, when you live in the mud all your life, you kind of get used to it until you take a bath, man, and you get scrubbed just nice and clean, and man, it's like, wow, that's what that's like. We have never had that experience, Brett. None of us are, because we're all deeply dirty. And even though there has been a cleansing that's really important in virtue of Jesus' work for us, the existential, experiential, practical cleansing hasn't happened yet. It will in the resurrection. And finally, for once, we will feel clean. Through and through, we will be once again naked and not ashamed. And then we will be ushered into a future, a wonderful future, that, as Lewis puts it, the door we've been knocking on all of our lives will finally open. Oh, I love that. I love that. See, that resonates with my heart. That longing that will finally be satisfied, that we've only had little glimpses of, little tastes of through our life. It's just a picture of something to come, and then it will be ours. And it's not just that it will be ours, Brett. He will be ours. We will be restored to the Father, and it'll turn out that we'll really see that all that our hearts have always yearned for was really Him, to be reunited in friendship with Him. And then, as the psalmist puts it, in thy presence is fullness of joy, and at thy right hand are pleasures forever. That's the story of reality.
And so the story doesn't just have a happily ever after for everyone. There's actually a heaviness,
yes,
there. There's a
gravity.
There's a gravity. There's a sadness for those who will be lost, who will take on that justice upon themselves. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there is a hopefulness. So mm-hmm. the heaviness and the hopefulness, what you're talking about here, the hope of heaven,
And what I want the people to see reading this is to ask themselves, where are they going to be at the end of the story? Because the end isn't resolved yet. We're not at the end yet.
Yeah.
Where are they going to be in the story? Because I say, look at what I've just told you, God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection. This is the story of reality. If you're a Christian, this is your story. But if you're not a Christian, this is also your story.
That's right.
Because it is the story of the way things actually are.
Well, the book is the story of reality. It is the most compelling story ever written. And Greg, you did a fantastic job with this book. I think this will be one of those modern-day classics. As I've been thinking about it, we've been doing some discipleship with our own kids. I've thought of reading this one with my kids, to kind of help fill in maybe some of my own deficiencies of really giving them that big picture and that systematic theology. This is something that, I'm always thinking in terms of youth and training youth, and also my own kids. And this is the kind of book I think I can't give a youth a Grudem systematic theology. I can give them the story of reality.
My 9-year-old was sitting in my easy chair while I was doing some work on my computer reading it. She was in the second chapter. So, that's a good sign. And you know what? I had not thought about just going through the book myself with my family and my kids and just using that as a point of instruction, but why not?
Yeah, absolutely. And
I've already done the work.
I mean, all the way from my 5-year-old through my 15-year-old who are still at home, they can get God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection.
Resurrection, there it is.
Well, great job, Greg.
Thank you, Brett.
If you haven't gotten the book, get the book. In fact, buy it in bulk and give it away, because it's the kind of book you can give, I think, to unbelievers and believers.
I think so, and I'm really glad to hear you say that, but that was part of my motivation.
Yeah. Well, the book is The Story of Reality. Get it at str.org. My guest today has been Greg Kokel, and you've been listening to Stand to Reason. And we are out of here, Greg.
Yeah, thank you, Brett.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.